Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to be back here on a Monday afternoon. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us, whether it's Monday afternoon or evening or even Tuesday morning where you are. And I got some good news. This is very good news for us here at Catholic Answers. Trent Horn's in the studio. He's out here in California with us. We're so happy when he comes. And it's just so nice to see you, Trent. Welcome back to California.
It is nice to see you, Mr. Cy Kellett.
It's amazing to me that they let you in California, given all the negative things you've said about California.
Well, I thought California was supposed to be a very inclusive kind of state. Isn't that the whole mindset of very inclusive?
Not to people like you.
Right. We're tolerant of everyone except the people we consider intolerant.
Yeah. Well, we're happy you're here. We're going to do... basically, tips for defending the faith. You can ask for anything you like. How do we talk about this? Or, you know, I've come across this challenge and I don't know how to answer it. If you'd like a tip for defending the faith, get it from one of the best this hour, 888-318-7884. Further good news, second hour, Dr. Ray Guarendi is going to be here. And that's always good fun. And he's also got just a great and very helpful book out about getting some calm in your life. You need some calm. Dr. Ray's got some words of advice for you, second hour. Again, 888-318-7884, 888-31 Truth. Trent, we've got you on standby along with Joe Heschmeyer for any day now. We expect a decision in the Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs thing.
Oh, yeah, we are on standby. I think everybody always waits every Monday now to say, okay, are they going to release it today? I think they're going to push it to the very end.
Really?
And all the justices are going to get into their mystery machine van.
Yeah.
And as they're hopping in, they're going to throw out the verdict and then peel away. Because in the summer, when the justices aren't working, they drive around and solve mysteries together.
This is the kind of incisive insight that we need from you.
This is true.
I didn't know any of this.
I've been following the court for a long time, and I noticed, though, most of the mysteries tend to be an aggrieved farmer wearing a monster mask.
Yeah.
Named
Withers?
Yes. Usually, surprisingly enough, it is Thomas who does the unmasking. He's the one
Thomas.
He's the one who says, I knew it was you.
He's the senior justice, I think. Isn't he the senior justice? Yeah, I think he's the oldest one there. I think he's been there longer than anybody.
It would not surprise me, actually. So, we're waiting on that. It's hard for me. I'm still praying because I was very happy with the leaked draft. And
yeah, I know. How's it going to get better than that?
And so I'm praying that we at least retain that or retain its substance. So whatever happens, God is in charge. But we will still, even if Roe versus Wade is overturned, the fight for life will now occur in 50 different states.
Yeah.
And more people will be talking about abortion. And so you want to be prepared to do that, which is why I actually have a neat offer. If you are a subscriber to my podcast, The Council of Trent, if you go to TrentHornPodcast.com, anyone who is a subscriber in the month of June at TrentHornPodcast.com gets free access to my new course at the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics called Arguing About Abortion.
What a good deal.
Yeah.
What a good deal. Also, if you're a member of, now that we're doing the membership things,
right.
All of our Society 315 members, you're going to do a special talk for them on Wednesday night.
That's right.
Did you forget that?
No, not at all. I am super excited to give the webinar, talk to Society 315 about Roe v. Wade. I mean, this is the first apologetic issue. As an apologist, I began my work focusing on pro-life apologetics when I turned 18. I didn't get involved in Catholic apologetics until several years later, at least formally teaching others. And so this is something that's been on my heart for a long time, and I'm eager to teach others how to engage the issue.
And I get to MC that, so I'm planning on doing a really good job.
I just want you to know that.
That's my plan right now.
I expect nothing but the best from Mr. Cy Kellett.
And if you're not a member of Society 315, you can just go to casociety315.org or .com. casociety315.com. Sorry, I got that wrong. And just sign up but Wednesday night. It's part of the stuff we try to do. We try to do stuff with our Society 315 members. By the way, it's your opportunity to get tips for defending the faith this hour, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. The Catholic Church is, I don't think I'm letting the cat out of the bag here, a pro-life institution. And so if as part of the defending the faith, you want some tips on defending the right to life, you are welcome to call as well, 888-318-7884. Trent Horn in the building with us, which is less common these days since he moved to Texas. I have to say, here in California, I feel like the Roe v. Wade, the potential for the overturning of Roe v. Wade has actually driven politicians insane. Like you haven't been here, but the TV commercials are all about who's gonna, you know, like have the most radical pro-abortion governing policy.
I think it's helpful to have issues that expose where people really stand.
Yeah,
that sort of removes the people who are ambiguous or try to have it both ways. Because you really can't with the issue of abortion.
Yeah.
If the unborn are not human beings, abortion needs no justification to be legally permitted.
Sure.
No more than you don't need legal justification to have a cavity filled or your tonsils removed.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But if the unborn are human beings, then abortion cannot be justified any more than we could justify killing a two-year-old because we're worried about them being a victim of abuse or worried about them being in poverty. So I want to put people on the record. Where do you stand on that?
Well, they're going on the record here in California. It's awful.
Then let them be consigned to, you know, the people always try to tell us that you're on the wrong side of history. The problem is when I look back at history, Cy, every single time a group of people in power said another group of human beings were not persons, every single time the group in power was wrong. What are the odds they're right this time when it comes to abortion? I'm going to put that at zero.
I'm going to say, yeah, I think I'd go with zero as well. I mean, I don't know how history will turn out because the thing I worry about is being on the wrong side of Jesus.
But the thing is, Jesus is the Lord of history.
There you go, Trent. See, that's why if
you're on the side of Jesus,
yeah,
you will inevitably be on the right side of history.
888-318-7884 is the number. We start with Beth in Kansas, listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Beth, so glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi. So my question is, how do I defend the Catholic faith for my Protestant friends who do not believe the Bible is composed of 73 Bibles, which has been determined by church councils, most recently Council of Trent.
You mean 73 books in the Bible?
73 books.
So, Beth, is your question, how do I defend that the Bible is composed of 73 books instead of the 66 books of the Protestant Bible that lack the deuterocanonical books like Maccabees and Tobit? Is that the essence of your question?
Yes, that's the essence of it. Yeah, we've even gotten into the argument that I don't even know who wrote many of the books of the Bible. Like, they were like, who do you think wrote the book of Mark? Was it Peter? Was it this young disciple named Mark? I'm like, I'm Catholic, and I go by the sacred tradition and teachings of the Catholic Church, and I'm under the magisterium, and I believe whatever the council is good to go.
Right. Wow. So Beth, I think that you're on the right track here. If the people you are dialoguing with are Protestant, and they affirm a 66-book canon of Scripture, I would really put the burden of proof on them. You could say, well, as a Catholic, I accept this canon of Scripture because it is the same one that was affirmed at the regional councils of Hippo and Carthage in the 4th century, and also reaffirmed at the councils of Florence and the Ecumenical Council of Trent. Speaking of which, by the way, a great tie-in here, if you go to my podcast, The Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, I recently had a debate with an Anglican, Jonathan Sheffield, on the question of the Protestant canon. So I think you should really ask them, why should you believe the Bible only has 66 books? What is your criteria for determining the canon of Scripture? And for them, it's probably going to be essentially a tradition that was received. So you could say, well, what tradition should I go with? The one that dates back to the Protestant Reformation or the one that goes back to Jesus and the apostles? So I would recommend checking out my debate with Jonathan Sheffield. That's on my podcast, The Council of Trent. It was probably like a week or two ago. Also, I would be happy to send you a book, because we got lots of neat books here. And it's a book on the Old Testament canon by my friend Gary Machuda. It's called Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger. So if you stay on the line, I would very much enjoy sending that to you. Would that be helpful?
Oh, yeah, that'd be very helpful. Yes.
Yeah, Gary knows all the ins and outs. He's very clear on in that book. So hang on, we'll send it to you, Beth. Thanks. We've got to take our first break.
Okay.
We'll do that right now and be right back with more tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn. Three lines open, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting support provided by Homeschool Connections. Homeschool Connections hosts the Catholic Homeschool Conference. The 2022 Catholic Homeschool Conference is June 10th through 11th, and the website is CatholicHomeschoolConference.com. That's CatholicHomeschoolConference.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn, our guest, your calls. Welcome. Tips for defending the faith, 888-318-7884. The weirdest thing was going on here last week. I don't even know if you know about this. There were people like auditioning on the microphones to be you in the audio version of your new book. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. I think there were people who were auditioning to be the voice of doubt within my mind, not necessarily
that
to be me.
That is a weird thing. But you say it like that's less weird. Like that. Wait, explain this to me. Why do we need someone to be the voice of doubt in your mind for your next book?
Oh, because I think it would give people a giant headache if I did an audiobook involving two distinct characters and I voiced each character.
That would drive people batty.
Yes.
Tell me about the book. The book then,
yes,
I'm assuming, has you and then another character that's your doubts.
That's right.
I gotcha.
Okay. Yeah. So we need someone
to play your doubts.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the book is called Devil's Advocate, Confronting My Inner Anti-Catholic. It is the first book I have written to feature a picture of me on the cover.
Really?
Have you seen the cover?
No.
I didn't know how I felt about it. People seem to like it. It's a picture of me and my little, like, wearing like a suit kind of, holding a handheld mirror in front of me, like a... What's this in front of me? And in the reflection, you see a red-tinted, angry version of me.
Oh.
So the idea is that this book, Devil's Advocate, is a book about my particular doubts about the Catholic faith and how I overcome them and how I engage them. So you get to listen in on the conversations how I use apologetics in my own personal life. And hopefully people will learn from that how they can apply that when they have doubts, when they have concerns. So it's a dialogue book in the tradition of Peter Crafe's books, like Yes or No, Between Heaven and Hell. But it's more personal in that regard about the particular problems that I have and how I work through the arguments. And I try to give the devil's advocate, the inner voice of doubt, a robust... He's not a straw man to knock over. He's a formidable opponent.
Yeah.
And so,
well, our doubts are formal.
That's right.
And to
make the book work, I had to make the other person someone who doesn't take easy answers.
Yeah.
And so I think it'll be a really a fun and engaging way. Fun. It reminded me, and I wrote this in the introduction of the book, that it reminded me of Screwtape Letters a little bit. And so C.S. Lewis actually said Screwtape Letters was his least favorite book to write, and because he hated having to come up with ways that for devils to come up with making evil sound good.
Yeah.
And this book was actually the least favorite of my own to write, to make my own doubts sound plausible and then to knock them down and to dive deeply into psychology and dwell on those types of areas. But I think it'll be very helpful for people and a way to learn apologetics without just a straight problem, answer, solution, repeat, back and forth.
Right.
It's more, here's an actual dialogue that... I try to make it sound as real as possible. So I'm excited that we may soon release it, probably in a few months we'll record it, but I would like to do an audiobook of it. And we're on our way to finding
it. So you need another voice. Yeah.
Need another voice. That way, because if it was just me, it would be insufferable. Changed up my voice.
No, because you wouldn't be able to figure out who's...
Unless I did.
You could do...
So devil's advocate, how do you feel today? Well, I feel just fine, Trent, but I think you are the one who should be worried. Maybe I should do 1920s Trent, huh? Are you so sure about all this Catholic stuff here?
Yeah. Hey,
the transatlantic accent.
I'm looking forward to that book. It's interesting that you have a book that you had less fun writing even than What the Saints Never Said.
Oh, I loved writing What the Saints Never Said. It was so fun.
Good for you. Matthew in Seattle, watching us on Catholic.com. You're next. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, Trent and Si.
Hi, Matthew.
What's up?
So I'm a Christian and pro-life, but I'm not vegan. But it's kind of a difficulty for me, so... Since humans and animals are related and the value of animals that we eat seems kind of uncertain, I guess sometimes pro-choicers say that pro-choicers are being haphazard with human life when they allow mothers to decide if their children are alive. I know I can say that we start off agreeing that human life is of value, so we don't really need to necessarily talk about it. But besides the fact that we agree on human life, is there any way of defending against that? Like,
is it the claim that are you saying how do we defend against the claim that pro-lifers are inconsistent if they oppose abortion but they do not support veganism?
Yeah, but without skipping it over just to talk about humans, you know.
Well, I think it's important in the dialogue to say that these are distinct moral issues, and so they're not necessarily related. That the reason that people will come to different conclusions about why it is wrong to kill human beings versus under what circumstances would it be wrong to kill animals. In fact, in most cases, veganism is rooted in the principle that it's wrong to cause unnecessary suffering to animals. I actually just had a dialogue with Alex O'Connor, who is the cosmic skeptic on YouTube. He is an atheist, a vegan. We had a debate on Pints with Aquinas a few years ago. And he and I had a dialogue we recorded. We were in the same city recently. He was visiting Houston, Texas, actually, part of the Capturing Christianity conference there that was going on. And so we talked about the ethics of killing. And Alex's view is that it's not causing the death of an animal that's the problem. It's causing the animal's suffering in like factory farming. So he doesn't believe either animals or humans, strictly speaking, have a right to life. It's about the causing of suffering. So for many vegans, they would say that they would probably be in favor of abortion because they would say most abortions do not cause an unborn child pain. Now, pro-lifers can say, you're right. Causing pain has to be justified, and people might disagree about whether the pain that is inflicted in factory farming is justified based on the goods of factory farming, like feeding people, sustaining a global population, for example. But the separate issue is the wrongness of killing. What makes it wrong to kill human beings? And if the answer is it's just wrong to kill human beings because they're human, because vegans will maybe try to create a moral equivalency, and I don't think that works, because most people would agree if you were lost in the wilderness and you had your a pig with you and your 5-year-old, it would be moral to kill the pig to feed it to the 5-year-old, but not to kill the 5-year-old and feed it to the pig to save the pig. That human life has a value that animal life does not, intrinsic value and intrinsic dignity. And so if that is shared by every member of the human species, that would include unborn children as well. Animals can have value, and we ought to show kindness to them. But when you look through the different examples, it seems very clear that animals do not have the same intrinsic value human beings have. You could have a barn filled with rats, and it would not be morally wrong to fumigate the barn to get rid of the pests. If you have a barn filled with human squatters that won't leave, you get the authorities involved, you go through legal channels, but if you gassed them to get rid of them, that would be murder. Because humans and rats have different value. Humans have an intrinsic value. And so while I think vegans can make a decent case that has to be reckoned with, and I promised Alex I would reckon with it soon, about whether something like factory farming, the suffering involved is justified, that has nothing to do with whether the proposition, it is always wrong to directly kill an innocent human being. If someone agrees with that, then they should be against abortion. And if they're not, I would say they're the ones who are being inconsistent. So is that a helpful start?
Yeah, can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
So I guess just for myself, though, personally, mm-hmm. it's hard for me to, even though I know for sure that human life matters, mm-hmm. I can't say like for sure beyond a shadow of a doubt that animal life is, even though it doesn't matter as much as human life, it still could matter. Like pigs could still, for example, matter enough that we shouldn't kill them. So that's what I'm kind of wondering, like, isn't it inconsistent to say, oh, well, since I'm not sure 100% that I can still kill them and eat them anyway, whereas if you're not sure if human life, if someone else isn't sure if human life is, you know, like a matters before birth, that they still should be careful. You know, I don't know if you get what I'm saying.
I see what you're saying. And there is an argument for the wrongness of abortion that says if we are unsure about the moral status of an unborn child, whether they're a human being or not, then we ought not kill them in the same way that we don't fire a gun into the forest if we are unsure that what we're aiming at is our hiking partner or a bear. I mean, suppose, for example, I went hiking with Mr. Cy Kellett and we got separated.
Here we go. Here we go.
And, you know, I see a figure lumbering through the brush, breathing heavily, wheezing. And so I assume, like, well, I think Cy is in decent shape. This must be a bear, but I'm not sure. You know, I should not fire. And then I would be relieved if it turned out that Cy is not in as good a shape as I thought. Like, oh, Cy, I thought you were a growling bear. I almost had to fire to defend myself. And, of course, that's why I would make sure that harm would not come to Mr. Cy Kellett. Because human life is so valuable, we take those precautions. So one can make the argument, well, okay, so if your only argument against abortion is if you're not sure, don't kill, then should you also take that position with animals? If you're not sure about the wrongness of killing animals for food, then you shouldn't do that. In one sense, that could be a case where maybe you're being inconsistent there, but a person could also respond by saying that if you're wrong, the wrongness of killing a human being is far, far worse than being wrong about the ethics of factory farming, for example. And so if something has a much worse consequence, like killing an innocent human being, then we take more care there to not make the wrong decision, to have safeguards, to not act when we aren't sure. But if we have a case involving animals, we might have more leeway because there are other goods we have to consider. We have to live, we have to survive. But for an individual, it's something that they would have to consider. And of course, Catholicism allows an individual to be a vegan. You can be Catholic and choose to not eat animal products. That's fine. The Church just does not mandate that, and it's not directly related to the pro-life position. The Catechism puts it this way in paragraph 2416. It says, "Animals are God's creatures. He surrounds them with his providential care. By their mere existence, they bless him and give him glory. Thus, men owe them kindness." So we owe animals kindness, but we can still use animals for human purposes because the ultimate human end is to worship God, to glorify God. And God gave us animals to be stewards over, but also to serve humans in their rationally ordered ends. So I hope that was helpful.
Matthew, I'm going to just put a shameless plug in here because we just got the head of the philosophy department at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio, to talk to us about this very topic. As a matter of fact, we asked him about the whole idea of speciesism, the idea that humans have this idea that they can use animals and eat animals and all that. June 22nd is the date we have it scheduled to come out. Sometimes the schedule will change, and with a lot of Supreme Court decisions coming out this month, I can't guarantee it'll be out June 22nd, but you'll get notified if you just sign up at CatholicAnswersFocus.com for notifications. CatholicAnswersFocus.com is where you can get all of our Focus episodes. Trent Horn, our guest, the number 888-318-7884.
If you are looking for a tip on defending the faith, you are welcome to call. We go out now all the way up to Toronto, Canada, where William is listening on the Catholic Answers app. William, your question for Trent.
Hello, Trent.
Howdy.
Hi, I have a question about, like, in the realm of abortion.
Okay.
So I was debating someone, and I brought up the fact that God has a plan for everyone, I said in Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, what about miscarriages? How can God's mm-hmm. plan be for my baby to just die?
Okay, that's a good question, and we will take a look at it when we come right back.
Got to take a quick break. Trent Horn, our guest next hour, Dr. Ray Guarendi, right back with to answer William's question from Toronto, Canada, on God's plan for babies who are miscarried.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Unworrying.
Is stress getting the best of you? Let us help you calm down and reclaim your peace.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Cy Kellett, your host. Trent Horn, our guest this hour. Next hour, Dr. Ray Guarendi will be with us. And William in Toronto, just before we had to go to the break, was asking about how do you answer someone who doesn't believe that God has a plan if babies are miscarried? That would suggest there is not a plan for people. Am I characterizing your question correctly, William?
Yes, perfectly.
All right. Trent?
Yeah, I think instead of using the phrase, God has a plan for everyone, instead we should say things like, God always brings good from any evil that he tolerates. Or we could say that God alone determines how much life he will give us. Because some people, when they hear plan, they immediately think, okay, well, this life has to have a certain kind of meaning or story that I associate with a plan. And since I can't see anything like that in a child who only lives for, you know, let's say a week in his mother's womb, therefore there couldn't be such a thing. Rather, I think we should see that death was never a part of God's plan for human beings. Death is something that entered the world through our first parents' sins. And God's answer to death is not just to give us unending natural life. It is to give us life that has a natural end, We don't know how long it could be. It could be 100 years. It could be 100 days. We do not know. And God is under no obligation to give any of us a specific amount. But his plan from the curse of death upon human beings is to give us spiritual life, supernatural life, to raise us up from the dead, to have everlasting life with him. And that is something that he is capable of offering to any single human being he creates, whether it is someone who dies at the age of 100 years old or someone who dies at the age of 100 days old in the womb. God, who is omnipotent, all-knowing, and all good, nothing can thwart him from doing that. So I feel like those who would try to cast doubt on the value of human life or on the existence of God by pointing to miscarriage, I would say that doesn't follow from that. Why would we give up belief in the one power that can redeem us from death just because we don't understand why God gives more life to some people and less life to others? Rather, we should trust in the author of life and trust in him to give us everlasting life. So that might be how I would approach the question, at least initially. Is that helpful, or would you like any follow-up on any of that?
No, that was perfect. Thank you.
Okay,
right.
Great.
Thank you. Perfect is a very high score. That is a very high score, Trent.
I think it's technically the highest score.
Yeah, I think it is.
I think it is.
I think you're exactly right. Or perfect plus might be the highest score. Andy in St. Paul, Minnesota, watching on YouTube. You are up next. Go ahead, Andy, with your question for Trent.
Hey, Trent. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I had a question about basically how Catholics rationalize the existence of Adam and Eve to go all the way to the back of, you know, original sin and the entire point of us inheriting original sin when we, I guess, aren't exact. When we didn't really do anything to begin with, kind of like a guilty of association thing.
Uh-huh.
So it was kind of a combination of that, and also how with evolution, how do we believe in Adam and Eve? Mm-hmm. Like, did God just kind of plant a soul kind of arbitrarily in a certain point of the development of species? Mm-hmm. Or I'm not really sure how Catholics view that, and how someone who does believe in evolution can rationalize original sin and Adam and Eve and things like that.
Sure. So it sounds like there are two objections to the doctrine that human beings descended from an initial pair, Adam and Eve. One would be an ethical objection dealing with original sin. Why is it fair for God to punish us for somehow being involved with a sin that took place thousands of years before we were ever born? And the other is not an ethical objection, it's more of a scientific objection. How could it be the case that all human beings descended from a single pair, given fossil evidence and genetic evidence showing human evolution over time? So are those essentially the two objections that you're wondering about?
Basically, yeah. And, and it's also like why God would sort of just decide to put a soul into, you know, a pair like that, at that point in history, and why not say when, you know, it was a different form of species?
Mm-hmm. All righty. Well, I'll take the ethical objection first. Original sin is not a sin of action. So we are not punished for original sin does not mean that we are punished for doing something. We were not involved in Adam and Eve's sin against God. Instead, original sin is a deprivation. It is a deprivation of the holiness and grace that we need in order to have friendship with God. So Adam and Eve had these preternatural gifts, this gift of friendship with God, that also protected them from things like death. And so this was given to them, and they could have passed these spiritual gifts along to their children. But because they disobeyed God, those gifts were revoked and lost. And so they could not pass them on to their children. So their children suffer, but they are not punished. In the same way that somebody who wins a lottery might be rich, and suppose they try to cheat and win more money from the lottery. If they are caught, they might have to forfeit all of the money back. And so their descendants will be poor now. The descendants are punished indirectly. They're not punished legally, but they suffer as a consequence of what their ancestors have done. And that's similar with human beings when it comes to original sin. So that would be the answer to the ethical objection. The other is a genetic question. You know, how could it be, you know, coming from human beings? Your specific question seemed to be, why would God choose to give, because some people will answer the question by denying the traditional account of human evolution. That would be one way to go about responding to the objection and just say, no, all humans came from Adam and Eve, who were created from the dust of the earth. If you do believe in human evolution, though, that there were hominids, Australopithecus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, why would God pick one point and he would give, let's say he picked two individuals and gave them immortal souls so that their offspring would continue to have an immortal soul given to them? Why would he pick it at one time versus another? Well, God might not have a specific reason, except that at that point in human evolution, the human body had a large enough brain and sophisticated enough brain to engage in rational thought, to come to a knowledge of God, to have things like language, religious expression. And so humans now had the ability to relate with God that, you know, a jellyfish could not. They have these rational abilities now that were raised to supernatural life with these preternatural gifts that God gave, but were then subsequently lost. So I threw a lot out at you there, but is that helpful, at least on those two issues?
Yeah, definitely. I think the only sort of thing I was thinking about also with the genetic objection, like you're saying, was so basically, you know, if evolution, you know, is a continuous process, and you know, we could probably become way, way more rational since the time of Adam and Eve.
Right.
I guess, you know, like, would Adam and Eve be less culpable for their sin if they were, like, significantly less rational than, say, people of today's point in evolution would be? Or
I think they would be culpable enough for the punishment that they were given. You know, for example, my 7-year-old has reached the age of reason, so he would be less culpable for offenses that he commits, but he would still be culpable. And in fact, some offenses, whether it was he or somebody else doing it, like saying something very rude, both might receive a similar rebuke. Even though he's less rational, he's rational enough to know he has done something wrong. So even if it is the case human beings, our cognitive faculties have improved over time, although, frankly, I think in some circumstances they have declined. If you look at random interviews that are done of at least Americans on the street asking them basic questions, I sometimes think that Adam and Eve might have been more culpable, and we've cognitively declined since then. But I think that they could still be held responsible, that they at least hit a minimal level of rationality that's necessary for relating to God, for understanding the moral law, and for other things like that. So I hope that was very helpful for you. I'd recommend as a blog post, if you want to dive deeper in the subject for you or anyone else who's listening, Ed Fazer, who is a Catholic professor of philosophy at Pasadena City College, has a wonderful 2-part blog series at his blog, edwardfazer.blogspot, called Modern Biology and Original Sin. Search Modern Biology and Original Sin, and he does a great write-up on this question.
Thanks, Andy. Got to take another break. We'll be right back with more tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting by Great Catholic Music.
Great Catholic Music, your one-of-a-kind streaming platform for traditional Catholic hymns and contemporary favorites 24 hours a day. Music that soothes the soul, that's safe for the whole family to listen to. What a relief. Great Catholic Music. Download the free mobile app or listen on any Alexa-enabled device or write from your PC or tablet at greatcatholicmusic.com. Great Catholic Music. Melodies for the soul.
He was a scholar, a preacher, a Capuchin Franciscan, and a defender of Christendom.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Lawrence of Brindisi was one of the most respected preachers in the 17th century, but he also helped raise an army against the Ottoman Turks when they invaded Hungary in 1601. He led the troops to victory against the Turks, carrying only a crucifix. He was declared a Doctor of the Church in 1959.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn here with us this hour, and we're doing tips for defending your faith. So if you have some aspect of the faith you would like a tip for defending, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Going all the way down to Australia now, Dennis in Australia, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Dennis, good morning. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Just want to make sure I got off speakerphone. Can you hear me clearly?
Kind of clearly, just keep stay right in the phone.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Dennis.
Oh, good. Okay, thank you. Yeah. This is great.
Dennis, we got some kind of problem. I hate to do this to you because I know you're calling from Australia, but I'm gonna have Thomas check to see what we can do.
Yeah, have him check the connection, see if we can bring him back.
So I'll come right back to you, Dennis. We'll do another call. You'll be next in line.
It's possible a koala might have been chewing on the phone line.
Oh, it's the wallabies that do that. Koalas, no. Oh. The wallabies are the real problem.
Well, I would imagine the koalas are the ones who can climb up there to do it, but...
I don't actually... This is a horrifying...
Do you think the koalas
admission.
Are smart enough that they've pinned the blame on the wallabies?
I do, actually.
They're crafty little guys.
I think koalas might be very intelligent aliens.
I think they're pretending to be asleep.
Like when the Navy finally figures out what all these UFOs are and they crack one open, full of koalas.
I bet.
Kat in Colorado, watching on YouTube, you are next, Kat. Please go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, happy Monday.
Happy Monday, Kat.
I had just a quick question. I was wondering what female apologists do you recommend, or any female in just higher academic fields that are currently doing any research?
Oh, man, Kat, you put us in a bad position because I know we're going to leave somebody out. But let's give it a try.
If I do omit anyone from what I reference here, it is completely unintentional. So I am just going off the top of my head. I will say it is more common to come across faithful Catholic women who are in the academy, who might be doing their professors and are doing research. Sometimes side people ask me, why aren't there more female apologists? And my question is, I do wonder why aren't there more female apologists. I would love to see more people in general doing apologetics, but especially women, because they can offer a unique perspective that men might not always be able to offer. So I'm always in favor of encouraging women. I've actually sponsored women to have free access to our School of Apologetics at schoolofapologetics.com to grow in basic understanding of apologetics before they apply it to their own research. But for example, professors, people that I enjoy in academia, women would include, there are philosophers, Bible scholars, a few in the academy off the top of my head would be professors like Mary Healy, who has written a great commentary on Mark, and she also has a pamphlet published with us that rebuts arguments from those who try to say the Bible does not condemn homosexual behavior as sinful. So she has a great apologetic on that. Janet Smith has great moral theology, and of course she's known for her work, Contraception, Why Not? When I look at other philosophers, Liz Jackson is someone I've had on my show before. She does great stuff on Pascal's Wager. Eleanor Stump is a wonderful philosopher who defends the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas, things on the existence of God. The late Elizabeth Anscombe, one of the greatest Catholic philosophers of the 20th century, was a woman, Elizabeth Anscombe. Her work is quite tremendous. Then, of course, there's my co-author, Catherine Pakalik, who is a professor of economics. And so she has great work on socialism, on family structure. So those are a few people I'd recommend in the academy. When it comes to more apologists, like popular level, I would like to see more women involved. Names that come to the top of my head are Layla Miller, my co-author for Made This Way. Another would be, let's see. Stephanie Gray Connors is, I think, not just one of the best female apologists. She is one of the best apologists in general when it comes to bioethics issues. So
she's just freakishly smart.
Oh, like, yeah. Well, Stephanie is one of the few people, really the only person, one of the few people out there who I am comfortable, if I could not do a debate on abortion and had to cancel, to ask her to fill in for me.
Yeah, she's never seems nonplussed, ever.
Unfazed, and she has good books out now on assisted suicide, on IVF. So Stephanie Gray Connors is, I think, probably is one of the best pro-life apologists out there. Not just female apologists, but pro-life apologists. Finally, there is an up-and-coming YouTube channel from the younger generation, the younger set. You could check it out. It's That One Catholic Girl. So her real name is Vanessa, but her channel is called That One Catholic Girl. So you just remember it. Oh, she's That One Catholic Girl. And so you can check her out on YouTube and others. And she does a lot of great popular level apologetics. And I'd love to see more women just going out and starting YouTube channels and blogs and interacting with others. We don't need to have a bunch of guys around all the time. I'd like to see everyone, and also people from underrepresented communities, people of color. I want more apologists. It's like Jesus said, the harvest is plenty, but the laborers are few. So those are some to, and I didn't mean to word vomit all these great people
Can
out there.
Can I throw
there.
Some in? I got to
But yeah, Cy's probably got a few good.
I want to mention our friend, Dr. Stacy Trusankos.
Of course.
And Dr. Karen Oberg at Harvard, both scientists who have taken up the role of Catholic apologists. Maybe one of the best theologians in the world right now is Dr. Angela Franks. Mm. And the reason we don't have her on that much, she's so busy you can't get her.
Yeah.
I wish that people would check out the theologyofhome.com, Dr. Carrie Gress's.
Yes, she's wonderful.
With Noelle Mehring. That's not really doing apologetics, but she is a great apologist. Mm-hmm. Dr. Holly Ordway.
Dr. Ordway has a wonderful book on imaginative apologetics. Yeah. She has a
she
book
wrote about Not God's Type, too.
Yeah, that was her conversion story from an atheistic English professor to a Christian.
Yeah, and also our good friend Monica Dumit, who if we could hire her out of Australia, we'd hire her. But I feel so much pressure when you say names, because there's just so many great women doing this kind of work, but not always officially under the title of an apologist.
Yeah, it's hard to think of someone who just does.
Holly Ordway would say she's an apologist, I think.
Yes, but I think someone who might handle the breadth of objections like I or Jimmy might engage or do debates dialogues.
Yeah,
I would love to see more women who would engage that breadth of kind of apologetic. Yeah. So, but otherwise, I would highly recommend go back and just listen through this clip and you can write them all down. But those are a lot of examples that we would recommend.
I felt like so much pressure there, Kat. How'd we do?
No, great. I got a ton of people that I can look into. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thank you very, very, very much. I'm going to try to get back to Dennis in Australia because we cut him short and I think we have a connection with him now. Dennis in Australia, there with us? Are you guys punking me? Dennis? Oh, there he is. Dennis, go ahead with your question. Am I supposed to be on line 6 for Dennis, or what line am I supposed to go to? Oh, okay. All right. Dennis in Australia, you there with us? No, hold on. Dennis, this is horrible. Okay. I promise. I know he's coming now. Dennis in Australia, are you there?
Can you hear me? Oh, hello.
Ah, yeah, we got you. You sound so clear now. Sorry, Dennis, that was like torture. Oh, that was humiliating. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Oh, sure. Thank you. Thanks, Trent. This question's been really bugging me for the last week. I've been debating on YouTube with anti-Catholics regarding St. Paul's first letter to Timothy verse 2, sorry, chapter 2, verse 14, he says, a woman ought not to speak because Adam was formed first and Eve afterwards, and it was not Adam who was led astray, but the woman who was led astray and fell into sin. And so these anti-Catholics are telling me that Adam was not deceived, Adam did not sin. And I'm saying, hang on a sec. Didn't Jesus come to earth and become a man to die for the sin of Adam? And
right, Dennis. These anti-Catholics, are they Protestant or non-Christian?
They could be Jehovah's Witnesses for all I know. I don't know.
Interesting,
but they're Bible believing Christians, and so they take everything literally from the Bible.
They take everything literally. First, anyone who says they take the Bible literally, so they're not Catholic, I ask them to read John chapter 6, verses 53 through 57.
Exactly.
So that's always my fun little experiment there. Here, I would say that what Paul is saying in 1 Timothy, this is not saying that Adam was blameless and Eve was blameworthy. If anything, it can be read as something that's the opposite, in saying that Eve was deceived and she fell into error, but Adam knew what he was doing and he stood by and did nothing. And so he did know better, and so he could even have a harsher condemnation. And so Paul is tying this in here with female conduct that is unbecoming, with Eve, it would be to carelessly allow oneself to fall into error. And so he ties that in with women maybe carelessly dressing or acting in the liturgy. And then with Adam, he ties that in that Adam failed in his virtuous duty to protect Eve, from the serpent that was there. He knew the right thing to do, and he failed to act. And that is the condemnation that would apply then to men often. But what I would do here is I would apply to say, no, clearly, in 1 Timothy 2, Paul never says that Adam did not sin. He doesn't say it. He talks about deception. But a person could sin, even if they're not deceived. Maybe they acted out of cowardice, for example. Rather, you should point them to Romans chapter 5, where Paul is very clear that Adam sinned. In Romans 5:14, it says, "Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sins were not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come." So here it is, it's very clear that he says that Adam committed a transgression. He doesn't even say Eve committed a transgression.
No.
He says that Adam did. So you can just tell them that they are not even reading the Bible literally. They're just reading their own interpretation into the text. So
by one man, sin entered into the world.
Right.
That's just two verses earlier.
Now, it would still...
And,
right.
That's not. I don't think Eve was the man.
Right. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, it was solely on Adam either. You could read it incorrectly in that way. This was a sin, as the Catechism says, committed by our first parents that separated them from God and resulted in the curse of sin being placed upon mankind.
Oh, Dennis, I'm so glad we got to talk with you. Sorry that was an ordeal.
No, I appreciate it. I'm glad I was able to get back to you.
All right. Thanks, Dennis. I'm going to try to get one more at least in before we have to go. So let me go back to the phones and see who we've got. I think we can go to Lewis in Phoenix watching on YouTube. I think I have the right one. Lewis, is this you, Lewis?
Hi there.
Hi, Lewis. Go ahead with your question.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
Hi there. Yes, my question is regarding the understanding of saints. I understand growing up as...
Oh, I messed up. Okay, so you want to know
the term saint is used in the Bible versus how we use it now. Yes. Hagios just means the holy ones, those who are set apart. In the Bible, it's used to describe God's people, and it can still be used in that way today. We talk about the saints among us. But usually when we use saint now, it's referring to a canonized saint, one who the church has officially declared to be in heaven and so is capable of interceding for us.
Lewis, I'm glad we were able to get the answer in.
And if you search Tim Staples, Meaning of Saint, at Catholic.com, I know Tim wrote an article about this.
Thanks, Lewis. Trent, wonderful to have you here. You're going to be here with us for a few days?
I will.
All right. I'll talk to you tomorrow again then.
Sounds good.
Coming up, Dr. Ray Guarendi, as we continue, Catholic Answers Live.